I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
If there's a better symbol of the greatness that has defined America through the centuries than the Statue of Liberty, I am not aware of it. Our pride, our unquestioned and exceedingly valuable American greatness has been achieved and solidified because our citizens have been known in the world as welcoming people to our shores, not turning our backs on them. We've been different from other countries in that way. Now, under this president, it's all about building walls and slamming doors. In her article in The Nation and Tom Dispatch, our guest today, Karen Greenberg, writes, from undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers to refugees, DACA kids, and naturalized citizens, the pattern has been evident and the message the same. Get out and or stay out. This attitude has hardly been the essence of a country that, for most of its history, has welcomed strangers and given hope to those in search of safety, security, and the rights and liberties of America's promise. End of quote. So many awful examples. Federal immigration agents under President Donald Trump just set a new record for arrests of undocumented immigrants who don't have a criminal record. Attacks on the civil rights of law-abiding non-citizens who work hard, pay taxes, and lead exemplary lives trying to provide for their families. And of course, the forced separation of young children from their parents, locking them in cages in seriously abusive conditions. This is America? Parents not knowing where their kids are, the government even losing track of them. This is not the America I would have ever envisioned, but here we are. Is it time for the Statue of Liberty itself to retire? Karen Greenberg's essay is titled Citizenship in the Age of Trump, Death by a Thousand Cuts. Karen Greenberg, thanks for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
Karen J. Greenberg is a noted expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. Civil liberties, what a concept. She's a director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. She's the author of Rogue Justice, The Making of a Security State, which explores the war on terror's impact on justice and law in America. Additionally, she's the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, along with many other publications she's authored and edited. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, The Nation, of course, and on major news channels. She's a permanent member in the Council of Foreign Relations. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Karen. Your article lends perspective on the whole concept of Trump's deep obsession and determination to build a what he calls a great, great wall. I remember the world's disgust at the Soviet installation of the Berlin Wall. America was understood to be the opposite of such walls. That was a vital component of our strength. Your article starts out with this. It turns out that walls can't always be seen. Of course, Trump has been pouting, stomping his feet until he gets his real physical wall. What is the real point of his wall? In what ways is it that, as you say, walls can't always be seen? In what ways is he and his supporters building a wall around the very idea of what it is to be an American?
Well, that is very much the worry that's been on my mind and the mind of many others, I think, since even before he became president, if you listen to some of his campaign rhetoric. The wall, in a way, is the obviously the physical manifestation, I think of something that's much broader and much deeper. So yes, there's the wall, and if I know you've seen the news, which has said that they're taking not just money from other parts of the budget, but individuals from all over the country to come and be at the border to keep people out, to process some people, but also to build the wall. But this, to me, is just the physical manifestation of something that's going on in a much broader policy way that has to do with other people who are trying to get into the country who traditionally would have been let in, starting with the Muslim ban, of course, but also individuals who are here whose status is being redefined. And so this is concerning. And the question is, you know, how broad is this? How many agencies are working to help implement this de-citizenship, or whatever term you want to get it, give it? And so I just wanted people to pay attention to it.
Well, we have to do that, absolutely. I mean, the idea of what it is to be an American, building a wall around that. What are you talking about there with the building a wall around the idea of what it is to be an American?
You know, so it was a pretty brazen thing to announce that there was going to be what became known as the Muslim ban. If you think about it, his policies, whether they're at the border, whether they're about the Middle East, are really sort of racially and somewhat religiously based. So they violate the idea of sort of how I started with the image of the Statue of Liberty, the idea of and not just citizenship, but the idea of what this country stands for in terms of being inclusive, being a melting pot, being welcoming to those who would like to build their lives here. And very much under Trump, this message has changed. And so it's changed in such a way, and again, I just want to say, of saying, if you're here and you think you're an American and, you know, your children can go up here, we're going to re-look at that, reconsider that. Even to, you know, people who have been here for decades who they now are deporting. So I think it's the message is we are no longer a welcoming environment. And while these people may be undocumented, many of them may have, you know, lied on some kind of form in the past. Recently, and you know, in the past, it's been the custom of the country to sort of overlook that and welcome them and say, look, you're hardworking people, you have jobs, your children are in our schools, your children are American citizens. We're just going to move on and, you know, try to have a wise immigration policy. But that's not what's happening now.
No.
And to decide to push all this time and energy into disrupting the lives of individuals, particularly those who are, you know, law-abiding citizens who have children here, are embedded in the society, who are a plus in innumerable ways, is just it's untenable. You ask me, what do I think it's after? Part of it's politics. Part of it's these not wanting to have the voices, the input, and in some cases even the voting of individuals who represent the Democratic Party in its inclusive sense of things.
Politics? No, I can't believe that. Well, it's interesting, you know, as I look at history, and I do like history, all authoritarian leaders, every one of them makes war basically on a system of laws. They want to become the law themselves. We have a system of laws. And you write that Donald Trump arrived in the Oval Office with an expressed desire to take an axe to the lawful notion of citizenship. Why?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. I mean, how do you know why? Is it because he himself is xenophobic? Is it because his base is xenophobic? And I guess part of it, I want to say, is does it really matter why? Because it may. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's so hard to answer that question when you see the country one way and it's being geared in such a different direction. I mean, the why, I do think simply could be it appeals to his base. I also think that this became a sort of test for him, which was he declared it, he wanted it,
uh-huh,
and he doesn't want to be opposed. So part of it feels like he just wants to win this one. no matter what. It's about the contest itself.
And when it comes to laws, I mean, he just, as you say, he wants to take an axe to the lawful notion of citizenship. It's very, very chilling in terms of, a democratic constitutional republic by having someone who wants to take an axe to laws and make himself the law itself. You argue that, quote, walling Americans in and keeping others out proved only to be a starting point. Yikes. Say more about that, please.
Yeah. So, the interesting thing is that this has been on my mind, and I say I'm sure on the minds of others, for a couple of years now, and even actually prior to Trump, where there were just some things done that gave me just kind of concern about the notion of citizenship. But now what we've seen, and I know this gets to something that's later in the article, but now what we've seen is this sense of this one case that really, I think, is what led me to write the article, and that is a woman born in the United States, grew up in the United States, who decided to join ISIS, became an ISIS bride, married three different ISIS people, has a child, and wants to return home, and has said that she will face criminal charges, and I am assuming criminal charges would likely be brought against her, wants to come home with her child. Her father has joined with defense attorneys to litigate this case. And what the United States is saying is that she can't come home because she's not a U.S. citizen. Now, that's a debatable point, and we have to really figure out what the record is. Her lawyers contend that she, because she was born here, yes, her father was a diplomat, but she was born after he was no longer a diplomat, that she is an American citizen. And so it seems, I think this is a very important case, because if it gets decided against her, then I think that it will be a precedent which can affect other cases that may not be in the terrorism context. So that's an example of one case. We've seen a number of cases where individuals, when they have gotten out of prison, have been deported even when their sentences did not call for it, when they have dual citizenship, and other instances, but those are just some.
Yeah, there certainly are quite a few. And this Hoda Muthanna, I believe is her name, she was 20 years old when it happened. And interesting quote from you here in the article, talking about her. The Trump administration is obviously using a distinctly unpopular figure, a willing former Islamic terrorist, to strike at the very idea of citizenship. Yeah, it's real convenient to have somebody who was with ISIS, but she is an American citizen. She's willing to face the law. And you also, your article points out the Geneva Conventions specify that no person can be rendered stateless by the revocation of his or her citizenship. What, if any, binding authority does this international law, the Geneva Conventions, hold over the Trump administration? Does that offer some degree of hope?
That's a very, very good question. I mean, and the answer is we don't know. We'd have to find out. But it's not a potent one. It's not one that the United States fears. And I think it's important to also say that part of this stripping people of citizenship who, for example, have joined ISIS is another piece of argument that's based legally that is pretended to be based illegally, I should say, which is this idea that some pundits have said, well, you know, she went abroad, she effectively renounced her citizenship. This is a line of argument that has been present in the United States since the beginning of the war on terror, if not before. And it hasn't been shown to hold any water, because under the rules and regulations that govern citizenship, if you're an American citizen, you have to verbally and officially give up your citizenship. It can't be a de facto thing, because you acted this way, you are no longer a citizen. It doesn't exist. And that's part of what goes into this whole argument. Then we get to the Geneva Convention. This is actually a very interesting piece of ruling, because if you think about it, the idea of rendering someone stateless, seen within the context of international law, international human rights issues, right, isn't obvious from the start. But taking somebody's country identification away from them is actually crippling in terms of, not just in terms of your ability to get a job, your ability to raise a family, your ability to have certain rights, but your self-definition, your understanding of who you are as an individual, which is a profound thing to take away from somebody, their identity. And so the reasons for this this law are deep. And the idea that we would create more, that the United States would contribute to a larger stateless community is extremely dangerous to my mind.
Yeah, for the security of the United States. And as you're talking, I'm reminded of, the 50s, the Red Scare, when loyalty oaths were administered to see if people are, back in those terms, 100% American. And, you know, mixing that with what's going on now, the same, you know, pretty far right wing mentality, if this were used back then, a lot of people who were alleged to be communists, who may have been members of the Communist Party, which everybody has a right to be if they want to be and still a citizen, you know, I can imagine that segment of the political structure wanting to kick those people out and strip them of citizenship too. You know,
so. No, that's the issue. That's why it's creeping incrementally closer to the citizen born in the United States, where we don't have, we don't question that and haven't in the past.
Right.
And it is getting closer to that. And that's why I wanted to kind of raise some concern about it. I think when Trump made the statement after the Mueller report was submitted to Attorney General Barr, and he basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, and these enemies are going to pay, right?
Right.
He said that.
That
it's the expansion of the definition of enemy that which you're alluding to, which is exactly one of the problematic things. And look, you could say that we're overreacting, that we're worried, but I'm not an overreactor. I'm often the person who says, no, let's just take a breath, let's step back.
Right.
This is actually an issue that really does concern me. I want to say something else, because you said, in the name of the security of the United States. And what I want to say on that point is that I'm not attributing it to you. I know that you're attributing it to others. The security of the United States is very much dependent, and of the world, of not creating an increasing number of stateless individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Stateless individuals have nothing to lose.
Ah.
If no country will own them, if no country will provide them food and shelter and a future for their children, then they become loose cannons. And we don't want that to happen. This is not a prescription for security anywhere in the world. So it's a short-sighted sense of the security of the United States for those who argue along those lines.
Oh, absolutely. And quite frankly, if you look at the whole so-called war on terror, that's made a lot of money for the weapons contractors. But increasing real national security, I don't think so. You know, when you attack whole families and bomb wedding parties and things like that, it's not a good way to win friends and influence people. Go ahead.
I think what the United States has been successful in doing, and it's what President Obama and before him President Bush stated as their intentions, was to take the war overseas, to take it abroad, to get it off of our shores.
Right.
And I think to some extent that strategy is the strategy that still works today. And I think some of this rhetoric comes up within that context.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Karen Greenberg. Her essay is titled Citizenship in the Age of Trump, Death by a Thousand Cuts. That's a heck of a title. And we're talking about what citizenship is now. And getting back to Hoda Muthanna and her case, your article points out that 13 other foreign fighters from the U.S. have already returned home to face trial. End of quote. What are the effects we can already see from the courts increasingly filled with judges chosen by Donald Trump? In what ways does this portend other effects on justice for all?
You know, it's interesting. In these particular cases, I don't think the judicial appointments have made much of a difference. The courts have taken very seriously and have been aggressive and harsh against individuals associated with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other forms of terrorism, like, for example, Al-Shabaab. They are, so it's once you're accused of it, and particularly if you've gone abroad and spent time with ISIS as a foreign fighter, as a foreign fighter wife, the courts are very, very hard and have been prior to this administration. But the larger question of what's happening in the courts is extremely important and pertinent. You know, within the first 2 years of his presidency, President Trump appointed more federal judges than Obama did in his first term. We know that these judges have been proposed by the Federalist Society for the most part, and that they are extremely conservative, and that there is the intention is to have the to wean the courts away what has been perceived as a liberal bias that's right. crept up over the past few decades. And so I think you're exactly right. You heard when Trump was talking about, you know, how his case would go through the courts. He was like, well, you know, it'll be tried in the Ninth Circuit. They'll be too liberal. Then it'll come here, and that'll be an end to it, right?
Right.
The Supreme Court, that'll be an end to it. That's an indication of the sense that the courts will be, if they are not already, in the pocket of this trend.
And in theory, we should have three separate co-equal branches of government. He wants to change that. And that's typical of authoritarian leaders. You know, they don't want a judiciary that can be a check on the power of the executive. So it goes.
Right.
The Trump presidency, well, I did want to ask about, in your article, along this similar lines, you refer to the September 2017 case of John Doe. You say the administration went after the concept of dual citizenship. Please tell us about that case.
So the question was, so John Doe had dual citizenship, American citizenship being one of them, and the ACL, and he was picked up in Syria, and the administration could have brought him back here for trial again, like I think they should do with Huda Muthina.
Yes.
And instead tried to asked for the ability to release him to a third country. And, you know, his name was kept out of the headlines or anything like that, or kept out of any kind of public discourse. So they wanted to release him to a third country. Finally, they came to some kind of compromise where they'd have to, there'd have to be some delay in, you know, a number of days between when they decided to release him and where they decided to release him, so that there could be some kind of adjudication of that. And it was just sort of an impasse, but it showed the intention of the government to just, once you've left, basically you've given up your citizenship. And he was eventually released to release. So he's that ended up much better case than we thought it was going to be. We thought he was going to be released to, or at least I thought he was going to be released in Syria, which would have been, you know, to an incredibly dangerous situation, and who knows what would have happened to him. So, but it was an indication of how far the government is willing to go publicly to say, we're not going to take these people back. We're going to try to keep out danger. Listen, this is not how you, I don't have to tell you this, but this is not how you keep out danger. You want to keep out danger, you use your courts, you use your Congress to pass laws that can, you know, help in a variety of ways to understand what criminality is and what it isn't. But this, it was just yet another indication. It's not just the policy itself they were trying to create. It was what they were willing to say on behalf of it, which is they decide in the executive who comes, who goes, who's an enemy, who isn't an enemy. And as you said, to the separation of powers, this is why we have these other institutions, not just for separation of powers reasons, but also for what actual justice is and who gets to say who's guilty, who's not guilty, who assesses the facts, etc.
I'm reminded that this president actually declared the Central Park Five guilty.
Yeah.
He decided they were, as it turns out, they weren't guilty at all, but he would have administered the death penalty on them or something like that. It, you know, that's why we have a judiciary system.
And, you know, he also tried to say that, you know, President Obama wasn't a citizen.
Oh, that's right.
Remember,
well,
just to go back to the citizenship issue in the same ilk.
That's a good point. What is a citizen? If he decides what is a citizen, somehow I think people of a darker color might be in a little bit of trouble.
You know, let's just point out here that the amount of power that was given to the president after 9/11 has been is very strong and unending because we are in a forever war.
Yes.
We still have the authorization for the use of military force since the fall of 2001. It bestowed in its name many powers were bestowed upon the president as the commander in chief of the country. Among them, you know, naming enemies, enemy combatants, etc. And so these power and many other things too. These powers have persisted through through Bush, through Obama to today. And so, you know, it's not like he created these powers anew. They've been there. He's just using them in ways that I think what prior folks would have said, look, trust the person in government. You have to be able to trust your leaders. And, you know, that's just not good enough.
Boy, those were the days when we could do that, or at least we were taught that when I was growing up. Now, the Trump presidency appears to be based largely on the use of fear, fear of the enemy, fear of the other. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt so famously said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Well, I think this is what he was talking about. One of the very first acts of Trump, of course, was to the Muslim ban, keeping him out of America. In what ways was this a manipulation of fear, do you think? What was he trying to achieve politically by this?
I think I don't know that it's so much about fear, although that was used the whole time. Oh, my God, they're going to bring violence. They're going to, you know, bring rape, you know,
right.
In terms of the southern border, right? Not
right.
Talking about the Muslim. I think the Muslim issue was always predicated upon the fears that were caused by 9/11 and in the wake of 9/11. I think the southern border has been other kinds of fears, but to safety and security of Americans. But here I think they have a different tone. I think what this is really about, and I don't think they are hiding from it, is that it's about, for lack of a better word, greed, in the sense of if they come, you'll have less.
Right.
Right? Shrinking resources as if we can't provide, the country can't provide enough, you know, jobs, food, opportunities for individuals who are here and who want to come here. And that's just patently not true. And I think that ultimately what it does is undermines a country's sense of itself as successful if this is the route you have to take.
Yeah, well, it's pretty frightening. Now, many countries in the world have seen a major uptick in nationalism, keeping foreigners out. It's not just in America. Very, very xenophobic. In Israel, for example, a new law declares that only Jews can be citizens. The millions of Arabs are not real citizens and never will be. Given that America has always been understood and taken pride in being understood to be a nation of immigrants, what accounts for this ascendance of this formerly underground anti-immigrant nationalism? It seems to be quite large.
Yeah, the global resurgence of nationalism that was so pronounced in Europe in World War II, to just name a time
yeah.
That's all kind
specific.
Of fresh in some of our older memories,
yes.
Has sort of, you're seeing this now all throughout Europe,
yes.
In a way that's very empowered. You're seeing it, meaning it's not just citizens, it is the governments themselves. And there's this idea of a kind of xenophobia. You know, it's not that, it's not unrelated to Brexit either. The idea
right.
that refugees and immigrants, asylum seekers, are going to harm the well-being of the country and,
right.
and preying upon fear, but really talking more intrinsically about taking away resources the way I was talking about
yeah.
before. It is surprising. It's both surprising and not surprising to see in this
mm-hmm.
country. We've always had a simmering right-wing
yeah.
White supremacist
yes.
presence. Yeah. It always seemed to be at bay. I've always had the question, like, was it less at bay than we're now finding out anyway, or is this really newly empowered, as it seems to be? But it's something we're going to have to deal with as a country, and we're going to have to deal with it judiciously, but also very, attentively, and I think we're going to have to do that now, and I don't see exactly how that's going to play out in Washington today.
Well, I have been, I guess, naive and surprised at how much racism came out after the election of Barack Obama, you know, and the whole idea of citizenship ties just right into that,
yeah.
It seems
yeah.
to me. And I did want to mention that, you know, there's this fear that's ginned up of them, those others, taking our jobs and using our resources. My understanding is the reality is the undocumented immigrants contribute a lot more to our economy in terms of revenue and many other ways by far than they take out. They just contribute a lot to the area, and it's just a false argument. Imagine that, lies. Hard to believe from this presidency. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We are on Keeping Democracy Alive, which is a group effort, folks. Our guest today is Karen Greenberg, and her essay in The Nation and Tom Dispatch is titled Citizenship in the Age of Trump, Death by a Thousand Cuts. And the countries where there is a rise in nationalism also share a commonality of right-wing authoritarians. Hungary, the Philippines, Israel. There's a rising strain in Italy and in Spain. These powerful executives have a tendency to assert themselves deeply into the judicial system, which has long been used to mete out injustice to Black American citizens, as we know. What might a new role for the system of justice when it comes to the old notion of equal justice for all citizens under the law?
Well, that is something, you know, we can't really predict. But what we can talk about a little bit along these lines, and what your question makes me think about, is what we already have now in our prison system. And in particular, what I'm thinking about is the privatization of prisons. And when you think about the privatization of prisons, the large percentage of African Americans that are in those prisons, and how it is a money-making business, the incentives to lock up more people because it'll make bigger profit for the private prisons is extremely concerning in the context of not just the judicial system, but in the context of what we're doing with immigrants in terms of detaining them, turning them over to private prison authorities for these detentions. I mean, untenable, or I would say undemocratic, institutions are proliferating, and the questions about immigration and migrants are coalescing with our detention and prison systems, and I find this extremely troubling.
Well, the whole fact that they're building new camps, that ought to ring a bell for people held in detention, for the kids, the adults, these camps spreading out all over the place. Whoa, you know, if you have any sense of history, that's very, very chilling.
You don't even have to have a sense of history. Let's say you don't, and I agree with you, the word camp just takes you right there.
Yeah.
But we have Guantanamo. And
true.
You know, the idea of detaining people indefinitely, you know,
without rights.
At Guantanamo, it's forever, not just, we use indefinite. Indefinite is actually a euphemism at Guantanamo. But of detaining people without real access to lawyers, without any efficient and timely due process, without any sense of where their future will be or what's going to happen to them, literally, of taking away their, you know, destroying their psychological integrity, among other things, and including those of children, is something that's directly out of the Guantanamo playbook.
Interesting. Yeah, and I wonder if I kind of doubt that they have habeas corpus rights somehow, which is somewhat important. All these things, you know, just a out-of-control judicial system is exceedingly scary. And, you know, if it's just under, if the judicial system is serving the executive, wow, That's not do it.
But a lot of this isn't even in the judicial system. You know, it's in the immigration courts, as opposed to, you know, in the state or federal, you know, criminal justice courts. And so it's even, you know, there's even less light on that. So it's complicated.
Yeah, and scary. Now, I was a state senator for a long time and been out 14 years. As a state senator, I attended many naturalization ceremonies, very moving events. These generally hardworking people knowing and loving America and being excited to be American citizens. They don't take it for granted, as most of us do. They will make great participating citizens. I mean, they know the Constitution better than most, you know, average people. Now, I have a friend from Jordan who's been working in the United States for nearly 15 years and lately has had a terrible time trying to become a citizen. It seems they just keep erecting roadblocks, just these kind of arbitrary roadblocks. I get the impression that because he is an Arab, a Christian Arab nonetheless, it is much more difficult for him. But can they really do that? I mean, he has an Arab name. I hope my assumptions are incorrect. Your thoughts on that? Can it be manipulated like that?
I think yes. Yeah, I mean, yes, I think the delays are immense everywhere. I think at this point, where they may have started based on race and religion and, you know, region, it may just be a blanket policy now I think we don't want immigrants. And you saw they tried to carve out an exception for Christians from the Middle East during the Muslim ban debates. But I just think the general idea is no. And so that just slows everything down. And then if you happen to fall into one of those categories of the groups that have been identified as potentially dangerous, then all the more so. Remember also that the government itself and many of the departments and institutions of government that would be attentive to these issues have been eviscerated. That they have way fewer staff. Many appointments, top appointments, have not been filled. In the case of immigration issues, they're moving. You know, there's an article. There are constant articles about moving officials, moving workers to deal with the border issue. So, you know, the delay is also partly just bureaucratic reality, given what's happened in this quasi-dysfunctional government. Mm-hmm. In a way, the dysfunction is serving their ends.
Yes, it is. They put the money where it's most valuable to them, and it certainly isn't to justice and the law and citizenship.
Right.
You write that Trump has, quote, also turned to naturalized citizens. We were speaking about them as being really dedicated citizens. What has been done specifically by the administration to denaturalize these citizens? Are there any particular cases, and is there precedent for such behavior on the part of the federal government?
Yeah, I mean, there is some precedent, but not at the scale and scope that is going on right now. So what we've seen is a number of individuals, and the numbers are escalating, and I don't have them at my fingertips, of individuals, and I'm just going to take this category because it makes it clear, who are here, who have been naturalized, but who, it turns out, lied at some point in the naturalization process. And you know, under the rules of denaturalization, this is one of the things that can be a cause for deportation, right? So it exists as a category. And this is what I was saying before about not every administration has paid much attention to this. You can pay attention to it. But the feel is that they're all of a sudden, you know, aggressively digging to find these kinds of things, no matter what the next 20, 30 years have looked like in this person or this person's family's life, and that these cases are on the rise, which actually dovetailed with the prior question you asked, which is, which talked about the evisceration of some of these agencies, really makes me wonder about, again, deflecting attention from one thing for another. It's also you talk about fear and you know, fear is a general thing, but the fear that has gone through some of these communities where everything's lawful, of individuals who have rather pronounced positions, and you know, are are practicing professionals around the country, they are scared. And I think that was part of the intention too, that there's a way of intentionally scaring people inside the country about what's going to happen to them, which is a different kind of fear than what you were talking about at the outset of the program.
Yeah, but it is a real fear, and I know it's getting more and more widespread. And I'm old enough to remember the old Soviet Union and the fear of the Soviet police, the constant right. fear that they would be there, the Stasi. There was that great movie Other People's Lives about East Germany, and I wonder, you know, these ICE is an easy target. And a lot of people want to abolish ICE. I wonder, in your mind, Karen, how similar ICE may be in terms of, you know, how similar they were to the old Soviet National Police, like untethered, tremendously powerful, and a lot of fear about them coming knocking at your door in the middle of the night.
Right. So I haven't made that jump yet,
that
leap, but I do think that there's that the perception of ICE in the country is really very much one of, you know, agents that are dealing in ways that are not above board, in ways that are cruel, in ways that are inhumane, and in ways that are not being held accountable to by our Congress and our courts. And so I think, you know, it's dangerous. I wouldn't have gone as far to say what you said. But I do think ICE needs to be brought into a way more restrained, transparent, accountable behavior. I also think this, you know, you ask about these people who are living in fear. And I, you know, what's that all about? You know, and I think that we really need to give some thought to that, because people who are that scared can be silenced in terms of how they vote, how they think, what they do, because they don't want to be deported. They don't want their families uprooted. And so that's another issue that I hadn't really focused on it all, and so thank you for bringing it up.
Oh, sure. Happy to do that. I can say things, and you don't have to agree with me, that's for sure. And the Supreme Court is, I believe that they've already started hearing the case regarding citizenship questions, which may be included on the 2020 census. Of course, Trump is all for that. What is the intent of the proposed new questions on citizenship? Trump's position on it, and what might be the effects of that? What are they trying to do with that?
I think that what they're trying to do is to, you know, the census is taking every 10 years, right. And what they want to do is, it's not gerrymandering, but it's in that pocket of things of trying to reallocate or discount individuals in a certain location. So, for example, the federal funding that goes to different congressional districts and different congressional areas would be reduced based on the count in the citizenship, right?
Right.
So, they want to add this citizenship, that's the idea. So they want to add the citizenship question to the U.S. Census. And, of course, the ACLU is fighting this hook, line, and sinker.
Right.
We'll see what's going to happen. The federal courts here at the district level in New York have pushed back on it, calling the citizenship question, and I'm quoting now, arbitrary and capricious and unlawful for a variety of reasons. But now it's being contested, and we'll see what happens. It skipped to the Supreme Court. And, I mean, that's something to have a very long conversation about, both the argument itself, how it plays out, and what does happen. But again, it's not just the results that's important. It's the putting it on the table. It's actually saying it. It's putting it there into the public discourse, because just putting it out there changes the conversation, changes the feel, changes the whole dynamic of what goes on. And so it's one more brazen thing, like the Muslim ban, which got reduced, curtailed, restricted, as opposed to the way it was originally put out. But it's naming and saying what's possible and putting it out there as a possibility that I think is fundamentally dangerous and destabilizing for a coherent society.
Yeah, putting a spin on things, like Attorney General Barr put a spin on the Mueller report. Who knows how it'll come out in the long run, but he put a good spin on it for the president. And what do you say to people who say, well, what's wrong with asking people if they're citizens? Shouldn't they, you know, be citizens? And what's wrong with saying that?
No, you can ask people if they are citizens, and they can answer, I'm on my way to citizenship. I don't think the question in and of itself, but I think putting it on the census is another thing, because it's got an intentionally political exclusionary goal in mind. It is not well intended. It's not just about getting information. It's about getting information that will deny people. That's the point. How can we starve you, reduce what you have? And I'm talking about these districts. How can we emasculate you so that your voice is silenced? You know, it's one of many tactics. You talk about taking the courts in one direction. Yeah. It's another way. The question is, how many voices can you silence so that a certain segment or segments of the country are in control? And all of these things lead to this kind of silencing.
Wow, that is chilling. So much about this administration is. Your essay cites a report by, I hadn't heard of, the Center for Migration Studies. What was that about?
Yeah, that's a really interesting report, because as much as I, you know, wanted to mention the case of Hoda Mohsina, the ISIS wife that went from the United States and wants to come home and face charges, there are a number of foreign fighters and foreign fighter wives and children that are caught in Syria that would like to go back to their countries, everywhere from, you know, Australia, New Zealand to the continent, the UK and Ireland. And different countries have made different calculations based on who can come home and who can. This is also relates to the John Doe case we talked about earlier. And so the Center for Migration Studies decided to do a report on this, just to kind of see, just to kind of chronicle what's going on. And basically, what's happening is that countries are doing their best, with some exceptions, to honor the Geneva Convention that we referred to before. Mm-hmm. They are basically saying, if you have dual citizenship, you lose your citizenship here. But if you don't have dual citizenship and would be rendered stateless, then we will take you in, but you will face charges, or we will consider taking you in. Sure. There's a number of cases where they haven't decided. In one case, I think it was Belgium, they decided to take they want to take the children, but not the mother, which is sort of a new tactic. But we'll see what happens with these cases. But there are a lot of them. Remember, there are considered to be thousands of foreign fighters from different countries, and many of them want to return to the United States. We don't have thousands. We have a handful compared to the rest, and to the countries in Europe. And so this, in an environment where xenophobia is dominant, where you have refugee issues already that have not been resolved, as you have notably in Germany and in France and elsewhere. This we'll see where this conversation goes and how what happens to international law ultimately.
I wonder how much power international law has. I mean, we've ducked the Hague, certainly, for crimes against humanity that may have been done in wars. And I can't help but think race has a little bit to do with it. Like if people wanted to come here from Scandinavia, somehow I don't think there'd be as much of a, fear ginned up. It's my opinion anyway. It's largely racist. It just plain is, I think.
There's a lot of racist rhetoric in the way these policies are sold and the way they're talked about explicitly in some countries, less explicitly in other countries. Look, the issue of race has been, it's not just in this country that we confront it continually, but in Europe as well.
Oh, for sure. And that is, as you mentioned earlier, Brexit was a lot about keeping them foreigners out. No doubt about it. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Our show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And our guest today is Karen Greenberg, who's expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. And she has a new essay in The Nation and elsewhere titled Citizenship in the Age of Trump, Death by a Thousand Cuts. And being an American citizen has always been highly valuable. The Trump administration's intent in the transformation of the idea of citizenship, what is it? What do you think it is, and in what ways is Trump, as you say, setting a precedent that could weaken the formerly sacrosanct idea of citizenship in the United States? Consider this the ultimate slippery slope, one that could, over time, transform both the image and the reality of what it means to be an American.
You know, I think it's redefining American exceptionalism as, you know, as it's not really redefining it, but redefining it in terms of how many of us had thought about it. You know, there is a view of American exceptionalism as that which is just what you said, inclusive, just, the place where people can come to feel safe, but and sort of a moral beacon for human rights around the world. Yeah, I think that this kind of exceptionalism is the, and by the way, these things do not need to be mutually exclusive, but I think in this scenario they are. But the United States as wanting to be the richest, yeah. At least the people running it the richest, the most powerful, which it has always been a part of the American exceptionalism since World War II, mm-hmm. And the most I want to say strategic, but I almost want to say unpredictably strategic. And so now you're seeing, you know, new alliances, new controversies develop between state actors after this period of really focusing on non-state actors. I think the message is resonating deeply with the American people.
Boy, I'm afraid it is. So what can people do? We are not powerless. They like to convince us that we are powerless. We are not. What can people do to address this whole quandary about citizenship and the redefinition?
You know, there are a lot of undocumented citizens, refugees, and others in cities and towns around the country. You know, ensuring that they have their rights is a place to begin, you know, at the local level. Uh-huh. I think much of what has to be done can be done at the local level. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is going to be this next election of 2020.
Yes.
And voting for somebody who's smart enough to understand the issues and kind enough to understand that treating people well is what safety is all about. Mm. They will treat you well in response for the most part. And there will always be criminals and exceptions, but that is not new to the human framework. And that the path we're on, and again, I say this as a person who is always trying to show the bright side of things, that the path we're on is a path for the unraveling of the security, and I mean the security and the safety and the mental security and calm that we became accustomed to. And we need to, you know, 9/11 disrupted it, and we need to put an end to it. This should not be part of our being an element in how we define ourselves as a nation. We have enough professionals who know how to take care of our communities and our country, and we need to help the professions do what they need to do and to make those politicians who lead with cruelty and inhumanity go home.
Absolutely. Yeah, go home. Leading with cruelty. Nope, not okay. Doesn't work. It's cruel and it's counterproductive. Well, if people are very interesting stuff, if people are interested in reading more of your work or finding out about the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School, any websites you can direct people to? I know you have to run.
Yeah, We have the Center on National Security website, which you can find. We have, you could read my book, Rogue Justice, which talks about the precedents for a lot of this. We have a morning newsletter that you'll find on our website called The Morning Brief that is about these issues. We look at the intersection between national security and civil liberties. It's called the Sufan Group Morning Brief. And
what was that name? The what group?
It's called the Sufan Group, S-O-U-F-A-N Group.
Okay.
GROUP Morning Brief, and you can link to it and subscribe to it on our website. It comes every morning,
And cool.
It's exactly in this wheelhouse. This is the only thing it's about. Where do national security and civil liberties overlap, collide, converse with one another, and the rest?
I will sign up for that, and I do plan to vote, that's for sure. Thank you so much for being with us, and keep up the good work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
Was a young girl with her heart on fire, born in the dust of the magic of history. It all goes on, yeah, the dream goes on. Can you feel it coming?
like the Green Party in Germany. Young people with visions and dreams. Nicaragua and Chile, Poland and South Africa. Freedom brewing, it's an uphill dream. Don't be afraid of anything. Don't be afraid.